Good evening, I'm Judy Woodruff on the NewsHour tonight. Deaths here in the United States from COVID-19 top 40,000 as the country continues to grapple with when to reopen for business. Then, Amy Walter and Tamara Keith analyze the politics of the pandemic and how the Trump administration is responding to the historic challenge. Plus, a close look at American agriculture, why farm workers find themselves especially vulnerable, and what it means for the food supply.
You've got families living together, so it makes social distancing hard. We know that oftentimes they are traveling to work in a truck and they're all piling up together.
All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. There are forecasts tonight that the worst of the COVID-19 pandemic is still ahead, even after the current wave passes. The warnings come as deaths in the United States have nearly doubled from a week ago. But also at the same time, momentum is building here and abroad to lift restrictions. William Brangham begins our coverage.
We are ready to reopen Tennessee.
More protests occurred today as debate heated up across the country over how and when to reopen the economy. From Tennessee to Washington State, opponents of shutdowns, some carrying weapons, blasted their governor's stay-at-home orders.
We've been affected by the virus in our family, and it's not a joke. But, you know, not letting people have food on their tables isn't a joke either.
But the Washington Post and others report some of these demonstrations are in part being orchestrated by pro-gun, far-right groups on social media. And recent public opinion polls show a strong majority of Americans, over 80%, favor keeping up distancing measures to control the virus. At the same time, even though the protests are often in opposition to his own public health officials, the president has urged them on, tweeting that states need to be, quote, liberated.
These are great people. They want to get, they call cabin fever. You've heard the term. They've got cabin fever. They want to get back.
Amid pressure to reopen, some manufacturers, like Boeing in Washington State, are getting ready to put thousands of people back to work this week. And Georgia's governor, Republican Brian Kemp, announced he'll let gyms, hair salons, and some other businesses reopen this Friday. But Dr. Anthony Fauci, the nation's top infectious disease expert, warned today that states could see new outbreaks if restrictions are lifted too soon.
If you jump the gun and go into a situation where you have a big spike, you're going to set yourself back.
That's what leaders in New York emphasized today, even as the state's death toll dipped to its lowest point in more than 2 weeks.
We're going to be smart about how we come back. We're going to be smart about how we turn the corner. We're not going to let our foot off the gas prematurely.
Local leaders say it's a decision that hinges on the capacity for much more widespread testing, which is still lacking in much of the country. But the president on Sunday argued again that, in his words, testing is a local thing and not the federal government's responsibility. But Maryland's governor, Republican Larry Hogan, rejects that idea.
But to try to push this off to say that the governors have plenty of testing and they should just get to work on testing, somehow we aren't doing our job, is just absolutely false.
And today, Hogan struck a deal with suppliers in South Korea to secure 500,000 tests. Testing in the U.S. has partially been delayed due to a shortage of the nasal swabs used to take samples.
So this is the swab.
The president said Sunday he would use the Defense Production Act to boost swab production.
How you doing, guys?
New York officials rolled out an antibody testing program to see if people who've been infected have now developed antibodies, which might offer some protection against the virus. It's another crucial test, but Dr. Fauci cautioned that many of the tests currently being marketed are not reliable.
A lot of them are not validated, point number one. Point number two that's important is that we do not know exactly what an antibody titer means. I mean, there's an assumption, a reasonable assumption, that when you have an antibody that you are protected against reinfection. But that has not been proven for this particular virus.
In Geneva, The World Health Organization also warned today that the decision to ease restrictions should be weighed with extreme caution.
Trust us, the worst is yet ahead of us.
Meanwhile, some nations around the world are moving to regain a sense of normalcy. In Germany, a nation that did widespread testing, small stores opened their doors to customers today for the first time in nearly a month. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm William Brangham.
Economic damage from the pandemic knocked the bottom out of the oil market today. The cost of benchmark U.S. crude oil for delivery in May actually fell below zero, and that drove down the entire stock market. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 592 points to close at 23,650. The NASDAQ fell 89 points, and the S&P 500 gave up 51. The collapse in oil prices comes as some producers are literally running out of places to store unused oil. Let's break down more about what's behind these numbers that we've seen never before. Special correspondent Ryan Chilcote has covered the energy markets for years, and he joins us now from London. So, Ryan, what exactly happened today?
Well, look, the price of oil was already cheap. In fact, just last week, people were paying just $2 a barrel for oil, prices never before seen. But the problem is that people don't have anywhere to put this oil. So if you're a trader on the oil futures market and you're looking to sell oil right now, whoever buys it from you has to physically take delivery of that oil and put it somewhere. And since they have nowhere to put it, because everywhere you could possibly want to put oil is already full, you have to pay that person to take the oil. So literally, if you want to sell oil right now, if you want to sell oil today to someone in the United States, you'd have to pay them as much as $40 a barrel. Now, this is a problem that in part is specific to the United States, because outside of the U.S., in many places, you don't actually have to take physical delivery, so you can kind of, you know, kick the can down the road. But even still, there are fundamental problems with the oil market right now.
Well, tell us about what are those?
Well, first off, there was already a big problem in the oil market in the sense that there was too much oil. And the Russians and the Saudis and the OPEC countries that Saudi Arabia leads, they had a production cut agreed. And then about a month ago, they failed to agree to continue those cuts. And they went into a price war. They started a battle for market share, trying to outprice one another, undercut one another on prices, and also undercut producers in the United States. The problem, Judy, is that then COVID-19 happened and demand for oil plummeted. And so even after President Trump encouraged them to come back to the table and do another deal, which they did last week by agreeing to cut production by 10 million barrels a day, it was too little, too late. And there's just way too much oil out there.
So this sounds like something that's going to be very painful for a number of countries. What happens next?
It is going to be very painful, and it's going to be painful right around the world. In the United States, you've got the shale producers in places like Eagle Ford, Texas, in North Dakota. They're already pumping oil at prices, you know, at negative prices, well below they produce it. So that means they have to stop producing if they can, and they have to lay people off. That's one of the reasons why President Trump just in the last hour said the United States is actually going to buy oil on the market and put it in the strategic reserve, 75 million barrels. But that's only going to lead, and the U.S. administration knows this, to a short-term Band-Aid for this long-term problem. Outside of the United States, also big trouble. Saudi Arabia, you know, to balance their budget, they need an oil price of about $80 a barrel. The global price for oil right now outside the United States is $25. So they're in big trouble. Russia's in big trouble. Nigeria's in big trouble. Venezuela's in big trouble. All that can really change things is, A, if the pandemic eases and we see some kind of recovery in the global economy, or if some of these oil-producing countries that need to sell that oil to fill their coffers agree to cut supply by even more than they already have.
So many repercussions from this pandemic. Ryan Chilcote, thank you. In the day's other news, Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his main rival, Benny Gantz, reached a three-year coalition deal ending a year-long political standoff. Netanyahu will serve as prime minister for the first 18 months, followed by Gantz. That leaves Netanyahu in office during his upcoming corruption trial. Authorities in Canada search for answers today after a gunman killed 18 people in Nova Scotia over the weekend. It was the country's deadliest mass shooting ever. The gunman was disguised as an officer, attacking some people in their homes and setting fire to other homes. Today, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau said all of Canada is grieving.
How could this happen? We may never know why. But we do know this. No one man's action can build a wall between us and a better day, no matter how evil, how thoughtless, or how destructive.
The gunman also died, but police gave no details. In Afghanistan, officials said Taliban attacks killed at least 29 security officers on Sunday. The violence came as the two sides are negotiating a prisoner exchange. It is supposed to be part of a U.S.-brokered peace plan. Back in this country, at least three people died after severe storms swept the deep south on Sunday. Hail rained down on Houston, and heavy rain in Hattiesburg, Mississippi caused flash floods. In central Alabama, cleanup began today after high winds and at least one tornado struck last night. A week ago, tornadoes killed 36 people in the region. The U.S. Supreme Court ruled today that state juries must be unanimous to convict criminal defendants. Two states, Louisiana and Oregon, still allow divided juries to reach verdicts. The high court acted in the case of a Louisiana man serving a life sentence for murder. And a federal appeals court says that a Texas ban on abortions during the pandemic includes those induced by medication. That overturns a lower court ruling. The state has temporarily barred all abortions as non-essential. Still to come on the NewsHour, how long will it take for America to reopen, and what will it look like once it does? The pandemic abroad, how Brazil and Afghanistan are coping with the crisis. Amy Walter and Tamara Keith on Washington's latest response to the coronavirus, and much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington, and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
As officials around the country are considering how to reopen their communities, there is great concern and debate brewing over how long shutdowns should last and whether reopening too soon could be dangerous. Donald McNeil reported extensively on these questions for the New York Times in a piece that explored how society could be profoundly affected and disrupted for the next 2 years. He's been covering epidemics for close to two decades for the Times, and he joins me now. Donald McNeil, thank you so much for joining us. You do open your piece quoting scientists as saying this could last for some time. Why? What do they base that on?
Well, basically they say that the notion that we're all going to be out of this in 2 or 3 months and that football stadiums are going to be open in the fall and we'll all be out together is a fantasy. That right now, somewhere north of 300 million Americans are still uninfected and vulnerable to the virus. If we all go out again, things will look good for 2 or 3 weeks, and then suddenly the infections will begin to tick up, and then the emergency rooms will fill, and we'll be back on our way towards 2 million dead, which we were when the lockdown started. So that can't happen, and we won't really get out of this until we have either a vaccine or a prophylactic pill that will let us out.
And the vaccine, we are told, Dr. Fauci says a year, year and a half. What do the scientists you talk to say about that? Why it takes so long?
Well, they say, look, a year or 18 months is really optimistic. The record for making a vaccine in this country is the mumps vaccine, which was made back in the 50s, and it took 4 years. Now, things have sped up in modern times. We actually have vaccine that part is sped up. You can make a vaccine candidate very quickly. You can't speed up the immune system. You still have to do the tests in people. And coronaviruses have problems. They have a tendency to create a thing called antibody-dependent enhancement when other vaccines have been made, which means the vaccine can actually make you more likely to get the disease rather than less, which would be a disaster. So you have to test very carefully against that. And then there's the production problem. Most vaccines are made in batches of 5 to 10 million doses, because we have about 4 million babies born in this country every year. But if we need a vaccine that every American has to take, that's either 300 million or 600 million doses if you need two shots. So that's a whole different order of magnitude in vaccine production and getting the factories working to do that.
A huge, almost an unimaginable amount. What about treatment? You mentioned medicines. What about treatment for the coronavirus? Could that make a difference in how people respond?
It can, and we're in the clinical trials now, and those are going to take probably at least a couple more months, depending on how many people get enrolled in the trials and how they go. Most of the medicines we know something about tend to help people who are already hospitalized and in trouble, rather than being something that you could pop and take as a pill like you can as PrEP for HIV. So we're not, I mean, there's been intimations from the White House that, you know, the hydroxychloroquine will work as a preventative. Nobody really thinks that. It might help people who are likely to crash because it's an immune system suppressant, but it's not an antiviral. And most of the antivirals we know about they're not Lazarus drugs. They don't save you. We're not seeing anything like that the way antibiotics used to make people, you know, come back from near death. So it may be a long time before we have a pill that's prophylactic. And then again, we have to make 300 million doses per day. You know, make it as ubiquitous as aspirin. So that'll take a while, too.
And what about testing, Donald McNeil? There's so much discussion about that now, about how there's just not the capacity for testing that is needed. But how much does that matter to getting us even close to back to normal?
It matters enormously. I mean, when Dr. Fauci says something like the virus will tell us, what he means is we have to get a stable platform of the same number of tests being done all across the country every day. And then and they have to be rapid too. You can't have it, you know, 3-4 days going up to state labs. And then you watch that level of testing to see how many positives and negatives you get once you've got a base. And different people have different estimates as to how many tests we need. I mean, I heard one estimate, 750,000 per day. I heard another estimate from Harvard that came out today that they think 5 to 10 million per day in order to understand across the country where the virus is rising or falling, so that you would know, hey, we've got a hot spot here, we're going to have to go into something more like a lockdown in order to get those people out of the path of the virus. So you're going to need a lot of tests in order to be able to spot that.
And so when people say, well, once we begin to say we're part of the way to normal, how much worry is there that we're going to see a resurgence of this? This is not a virus that's just going to go away, is it?
No, and nobody really believes the virus is going to fade in the summer either. That, you know, it's spreading in India, it's spreading in Brazil, it's spreading in the Philippines, it's spreading very happily in hot weather countries, and that's typical with viruses. If they have victims they've never seen before, the temperature doesn't really make a big difference. You know, the worry is that as we're in lockdown, we may be the hammer in the dance. The hammer has come down, and now we sort of dance out of lockdown for a little while, but then realize, uh-oh, we're getting infections, and that will mean deaths rising again. So we go back into lockdown, and then wait a little while, it'll drop. And on the epidemiological models, it looks like a row of shark's teeth, where you see deaths rising, and then deaths falling, and then deaths rising, and deaths falling. And that could go on until we have a vaccine, which might take 2 or 3 years. So a lot of things might happen. Some people might deliberately decide to infect themselves to get out, you know, young, healthy people. That will be a very risky thing to do, but people may just get really, really fed up of being in lockdown while the rest of the world is out having fun and taking their jobs. So there'll be a lot of psychological changes for this country over the next couple of years.
And do we ever get back to a pre-COVID normal, if we can remember what that was like?
Hopefully there will be a vaccine ultimately, and that will, once we're all protected, we're back to the where we are with flu shots and measles shots and everything else. Life will go back on again, and maybe life will, you know, become better. This is like going through a war, and, you know, in the post-war periods after World War I and World War II, people's attitude towards lives changed. They wanted the League of Nations. They wanted the United Nations. They you know, income equality changed. Life was, for people who lived through that generation, often they recognized it was more precious. It was like living through the Blitz. People began to know what was important in life and what wasn't. But that's sort of how I stay hopeful through all this. But we're not there yet, and we got to go through some pain before then.
But that's something we can at least hang on to, even as we realize the reality of this. Donald McNeil with the New York Times, thank you so much.
Thank you for inviting me.
COVID-19 is disrupting the farming industry on many levels. The Trump administration recently announced that it will spend $19 billion to help farmers. But as Stephanie Tsai reports, they aren't the only ones who need help.
The cows still have to be milked. But dairy farmers are dumping millions of gallons of their output. Endless acres of lettuce remain unpicked at the peak of the spring harvest.
It is very difficult, not just for me, you know, on the economic side, but emotional side as well.
And tractors are destroying crops, plowing them back into the ground.
You can see all the beautiful beings on these plants that were scheduled to go to the restaurant industry.
The closure of restaurants and schools has shut down the food service industry, forcing farmers to make difficult decisions. But if there's so much food, why are grocery store freezers so empty? Repackaging and rerouting supply is an involved process, says Dave Puglia, president and CEO of the Western Growers Association.
If you think about a grocery store, you're going to see something on the shelf that's packaged for you as a consumer. You go to a restaurant, they're buying in bulk. So we can't, unfortunately, flip that infrastructure over all that quickly.
And what about donating the food to charitable food organizations so desperately in demand right now? Food banks only have so much storage, and getting the surplus to them also costs money.
That farmer has to decide whether to spend the money to harvest it, which is the most expensive part of farming in the produce industry. So if you already know you're taking 100% loss, do you want to make it 150% by harvesting a product that doesn't have a profitable home?
Meanwhile, the livestock industry is facing other problems. Meat processing plants around the country have suspended operations due to outbreaks, including one of the nation's largest pork plants in South Dakota. The Smithfield Foods plant in Sioux Falls had hundreds of employees test positive for COVID-19, and at least one has died. In rural Georgia and Iowa, the virus has claimed the lives of six employees of Tyson Foods, and other Tyson plants have dozens of cases. And in Greeley, Colorado, the JBS beef plant has temporarily closed after at least four workers died of the virus. One of them was Saul Sanchez, whose daughter and co-workers accused the plant of not taking precautions soon enough.
Now they have everything. Now they are spacing them. Now they're putting pictures of where, but it's too late. I mean, it's not too late for those employees, but it's too late for my dad.
The plant closures may be necessary to ensure worker safety, but they also mean farmers are running out of places to take their livestock, and the potential for a meat shortage looms. Tom Peterson is Minnesota's agriculture commissioner.
You know, it's been really vast. I mean, it's really affecting just about every sector of agriculture right now. Pork is probably hit the hardest, but also our egg farmers, our ethanol farmers, beef. It's really across the board, and it's going to get worse probably before it gets better.
That may also hold true for farm workers.
We work in the fields, and we have to put in extra effort to get the work done so that families have food in their homes. If there are no workers doing this, there won't be food in the stores.
In the COVID-19 pandemic, they're considered by the government essential workers, but many are working without essential benefits.
I have to work to pay the rent, the bills. These things don't wait for you.
Like many other farm workers, if Bernadita falls sick or stops working, she doesn't have a safety net. According to the U.S. Department of Labor, about half of farm workers are undocumented immigrants.
I don't have papers. I don't have the same benefits as someone who has papers.
Dr. Eva Galvez is the daughter of farm workers from Mexico and works at a community health center outside Portland, Oregon.
Tell me what your greatest concerns are when it comes to farm workers' health and COVID-19.
We've got families living together, so it makes social distancing hard. We know that oftentimes they are traveling to work in a truck and they're all piling up together, and it's really hard to do social distancing there. You know, even things, something as simple as washing your hands often can be really difficult if your hand washing station is far from your station.
And farm workers that spoke to the NewsHour said they weren't getting adequate information.
They've never spoken to us about the virus. Everything we know, the care we take, the precautions, we know thanks to the news, what we watch on television, on social networks.
That's only part of what leaves these workers more vulnerable, says Armando Alenis, Secretary Treasurer of the United Farm Workers.
The stimulus bill excluded workers that are undocumented, so they can't collect unemployment. The additional $600 a week that other people are getting, they can't get that.
Some farmers do have protections in place. Jim Cochran is the owner of Swanton Berry Farms in Davenport, California, a union grower with 25 workers who have benefits.
You know, I don't want anybody who's sick working at the farm. Way to assure that is to pay their wages during any time that they might be sick.
But even farm workers under a union contract are concerned.
What would happen if one of my colleagues got sick with this virus? The company would automatically close. They would send us home. What are we going to do without getting paid?
In California, there may be some temporary relief after Governor Gavin Newsom announced $75 million in state funding for undocumented workers. From the crop pickers to farm owners, COVID-19 is taking its toll.
We've had 5 years of down prices. You know, we've had farmers that I know personally take their own lives. We've had a lot of farmers with really high stress.
Pressures on U.S. farmers were compounded in recent years by the Trump administration's trade war with China. Bankruptcies for family farms shot up 20% last year.
And so I just ask people to keep farmers in their thoughts as we go into this as well.
The pandemic is making the already risky farming business even more unpredictable, not only for the people that make up the farming industry, but for the nation's food supply.
Part of the Trump administration's plan to bail out farmers includes spending $3 billion to buy some of that produce that we've seen wasted on farms, and they're trying to find ways to distribute it to food banks. Joining me now to discuss how the epidemic is affecting the business of farmers, we're joined by Amy Mayer from Ames, Iowa. Amy is the agriculture reporter for Iowa Public Radio and Harvest Public Media. Amy, you have covered deadly disease outbreaks among farm animals, such as avian flu, and farmers always seem to have to adapt. How is this pandemic different?
There's a couple ways I think that it's different. For one thing, with a livestock disease outbreak, that's something that really impacts farmers first, and the rest of the public may find out about it after they've been dealing with it for some time. And other people may not really feel it has a direct impact on their lives. With this one, obviously, the entire country was affected pretty much all at the same time. And so in that sense, farmers are right alongside the rest of the population. The other thing that's important is that there are certain types of challenges that farmers can anticipate and they can insure themselves against, such as a severe weather event and to some extent livestock diseases. Clearly, this is something that nobody saw coming and nobody had any kind of preparation for.
I want to talk about what's happening at the meat processing plants. When it comes to those COVID-19 clusters, Amy, are companies responsibility at all, and are they doing anything differently now?
We're seeing a little bit of variation among the different companies. We have heard that in some cases, temperatures are taken as workers enter the building each day. Some of the companies may have given masks or face shields to employees, although in other cases, it seems that's been up to employees to provide for themselves. We're getting scattered reports of plexiglass dividers going up in between the different stations on a line. Those are something that wouldn't normally be there, but there have not been specific required guidelines from any federal agency or even any of the state and local agencies about what the companies could or should be doing.
And clearly, a lot of employees are now being sent home. These meat processing plants, some of them are having to suspend operations. Should consumers expect meat shortages to result from this?
Right now, what we've been hearing is that there won't actually be shortages of meat in the big picture. What consumers may start to see is that the cuts of meat, the types of meat that are available at their grocery stores may be a little different than what they've been used to, or may not get refilled into those cases at the grocery store as quickly as they've become accustomed to. It's important also to remember that restaurants and other institutions that serve food have been shut down, and that happened before we started seeing the problems with the processing plants. That's meant a lot of the meat that you talked about being redistributed to food banks may ultimately also be able to be repackaged and redistributed and become available where supermarkets might have some cuts that normally would just be at fine dining establishments.
Amy Mayer of Iowa Public Radio and Harvest Public Media joining us from Ames, Iowa. Amy, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
How does a country fight COVID-19 when its own president says it's not a serious matter? Brazil is finding out. Intensive care beds in the capital are almost out. Healthcare systems in multiple states are overwhelmed, and Brazil now has 40,000 COVID-19 cases, the highest number in Latin America. But President Jair Bolsonaro prioritizes Latin America's largest economy in the face of the pandemic. Nick Schifrin reports.
This weekend, the head of Brazil's government led a protest against his own government. President Jair Bolsonaro rallied supporters practicing no social distancing and invoked Brazil's past military dictatorship to disparage the government's COVID-19 restrictions.
I'm sure that all of us will one day swear to give our lives for our country, and we will do whatever is possible to change the destiny of Brazil. Enough of the old policy.
Bolsonaro has repeatedly called COVID-19 a little flu. His rhetoric has been as dismissive as his actions.
No meu caso particular,
given my athletic history, if I was to be infected, it would not necessarily concern me. I wouldn't feel anything other than at most a little cold.
Echoing President Trump, he criticized governors who ordered lockdowns, including of Rio's famous beaches. But many Brazilians think there's something rotten in Rio and have spent their evenings protesting Bolsonaro.
We are in a dark situation. We don't have a clue of how many affected people we have in Brazil.
Ivan Franca Jr. is an epidemiologist at the University of Sao Paulo. He says the official death toll is a vast underreporting.
The federal governments have been very slow to buy and to distribute new coronavirus test.
Brazil has several communities at particular risk. Social distancing is impossible in the sprawling low-income neighborhoods known as favelas. There are 6 confirmed cases in Parisópolis, with a population of 120,000. A former soccer star hired round-the-clock medical service, the favela's only health care, says ambulance company owner Diego Cabral.
Due to the deficiencies of the public system, the overload of the public health system was directed all towards us.
And Brazil has 350 indigenous tribes, whom Bolsonaro has disparaged with racist language and opened their land to commercial mining. Now, indigenous leaders say Bolsonaro's policies make them more vulnerable to COVID-19.
Our soil is contaminated. We can't farm. We're here fearing that our people will die of hunger. And we don't know how long the coronavirus will last.
Earlier this month, Bolsonaro flaunted his own government's social distancing orders. Those orders were implemented by Health Minister Luiz Henrique Mandetta, who criticized Bolsonaro.
When you see people entering a bakery, entering a supermarket, lining up one after another, leaning against each other, this is clearly the wrong thing.
4 days later, Mandetta was fired. And when Bolsonaro announced a new health minister, he emphasized the economy.
Life has no price, but the economy, the employment, has to go back to normal.
Unemployment is growing, leading to growing crowds at vendors who give away unsold food.
I have 4 children, and I have to go out and find food.
The government doesn't give us a solution, and the people suffer.
Every day in Rio, firefighter Elielson Silva climbs his ladder to serenade the city. He plays elegies for a time before Corona, a time before the government's disdain for its own policies threatened its citizens' lives. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Nick Schifrin.
The scourge of COVID-19 is even more severe in underdeveloped nations. Add in an active war zone, as in Afghanistan, and fighting the virus is even harder. There are now thousands of cases there, including more than a dozen within the presidential palace alone. As special correspondent Jane Ferguson reports, fighting a war and the virus comes at a stark moment.
Combating the coronavirus is a sharp turn for the Taliban, which has been fighting an armed insurgency against American and Afghan forces for nearly 20 years. Yet in Afghanistan, the Taliban want to be seen battling COVID-19 too. Public awareness events like this one have taken place in recent weeks in areas they control. The group keen to showcase some form of medical preparedness. We have ambulances and ordered our medical teams to reach each and every house quickly and bring any suspected coronavirus patient to a place for quarantine, this Taliban health official tells people in rural Wardak province. Afghan journalist and filmmaker Nasir Rahim traveled to the Taliban-controlled Tangi Valley, about 60 miles south of the capital, Kabul, for the NewsHour to discover if the group is capable of stemming the virus across rural Afghanistan. Much of these efforts are largely public relations, staged for the cameras. Social distancing remains a foreign concept. Officials meet in small rooms together and mosques are open to large congregations. Yet, for a group that so often shows disregard to civilian lives in its bombing campaigns, there is a sense of growing concern. Medical facilities in rural Afghanistan are at best basic, and if the virus rages through here, it could kill many. The Taliban, long hostile to foreign aid groups, says it has changed tack.
Our health commission has said any NGOs that want help from us, we will facilitate that, and they should reach out to us. We are trying to coordinate with international NGOs to bring assistance.
The greatest fear here is people coming home from neighboring Iran, where a massive outbreak of coronavirus has gripped the country. More than 3 million Afghans live and work there. And in March alone, 150,000 poured across the border, coming home. Many of them to cities like Herat, close to the border, and then on to rural provinces, bringing the disease with them. The Taliban says it is forcing returnees to quarantine. The truth is, testing for the virus out here in Taliban territory is practically non-existent. They do not seem to understand how contagious the virus is. Some fighters are taking precautions, others not. If people get sick, they have little option but to travel outside Taliban territory to cities controlled instead by the Afghan government, hoping for treatment. But those places are also woefully unprepared.
In Herat, we have around 20 ventilators. In Kabul, around 20 ventilators. And once we purchase more ventilators, we will provide them more. And in Kabul, we have around this number.
Afghanistan's health ministry spokesman gives a daily press conference on the situation in the capital, Kabul, where the lockdown has tightened in recent days. In a city where most people make a living from day labor, socially isolating means desperate times for millions. Despite some food handouts by the government, food prices have increased sharply as borders shut and supply routes are disrupted by efforts to keep the virus out. People are going hungry, yet authorities have little choice but to try to prevent the spread.
We have to start from somewhere. It's better than nothing. And day by day, we intensify our efforts.
The U.S. military has halted troop movement in and out of the country, hoping to prevent moving the virus around with it. The commander of the U.S. and NATO mission here, General Austin Miller, says the disease can only be controlled if there is peace.
It's something that affects the entire world. And it'll affect coalition forces and Afghan security forces as well. The focus on this particular virus has to be on preventing the spread, which is difficult under even normal circumstances, but almost impossible if we have violence.
President Ashraf Ghani's election win last September was contested by his rival, leading to infighting and uncertainty. Now, rolling out Washington's deal with the Taliban for a U.S. withdrawal has been delayed, too. The Kabul government was excluded from the talks between the U.S. and the Taliban and still needs to strike its own peace deal with the group. Yet, Ghani's government took months to form a negotiating team and begin the release of Taliban prisoners, something the group demanded before talks could begin. In March, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo lost patience and slashed $1 billion in aid to the Afghan government. Laurel Miller is a former U.S. special representative to Afghanistan and Pakistan.
It will have to come at least in large part, if not entirely, from the funding of the Afghan security forces, because currently the U.S. gives a little over $500 million a year in civilian assistance to Afghanistan. And in the current year, over $4 billion was allocated for support for those security forces. So there's no way to cut $1 billion without cutting into the support for the security forces.
With the White House losing patience and punishing the Kabul government with massive funding cuts, the Ghani administration is losing its ability to negotiate a strong settlement.
In the past, the U.S. was, I wouldn't just say unwilling, I would say unable to make those kinds of threats, because certainly not able to make those kinds of threats credibly, because the U.S. had a strategy in place that depended on the success and survival of the Afghan government. The fact that the U.S. is now willing to make those kinds of threats, I think credibly, suggests that the U.S. is turning towards a strategy that doesn't see the success and survival of the Afghan government as important to American security interests.
No matter how soon American troops will head home, it won't be before the country is forced to face a public health crisis for which it is not equipped. The virus is being called a great leveler, encircling nations and people of all incomes and ethnicities. But in reality, some countries, like Afghanistan, are that much more vulnerable than others. Now, as well as surviving fighting and near daily suicide attacks, its citizens are left to fight alone against an invisible, frightening enemy. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Jane Ferguson.
Back in this country, President Trump's coronavirus response, from social distancing to a ban on travel from China, is being challenged from both sides of the political aisle. Amna Nawaz has more for Politics Monday.
Here to break down the political motivations behind those anti-social distancing protests and the state of the 2020 presidential race, Amy Walter of the Cook Political Report and host of Public Radio's Politics with Amy Walter, and Tamara Keith of NPR. She also co-hosts the NPR Politics podcast. Welcome to you both. Good to see you both from a safe distance. Amy, I want to ask you about those protests William reported on earlier in the show. I'm sure people have been seeing these pictures across the headlines. People protesting the stay-at-home and shelter-at-home directives that so many are now under. They're modest demonstrations, but they are popping up across the country. When you look at where they are happening, what stands out to you?
It's not so much where they're actually protesting, because it seems like it's popping up in all kinds of states, red states and blue states, Democratic governors, Republican governors. What stands out is some of the polling we have right now on how people feel about these stay-at-home orders. And what it suggests is these folks who are out there protesting represent a pretty small element of the American public opinion right now. About 30%, both in a new NBC Wall Street Journal poll and a Pew poll, saying that they are more worried that their governor or the country won't open up soon enough than they are worried that we'll open up too soon and more people will get sick. The question now, Amna, is whether this 30% represents a ceiling or whether that's a floor. Will we see that start to grow, especially if the president keeps focusing on this and focusing his anger on certain governors? Because what we saw in, for example, the Pew poll is that while Democrats are united on the worry that government is going to allow businesses to open too soon, and maybe the spread will get out of control that way, Republicans are evenly divided on this question. And so I'm going to be watching very closely over this next week or so to see how the president is responding, as some of these states are saying they're going to open at the end of this week, like Georgia, or starting in the very first week in May.
Tam, what about that tension? You saw the numbers in that poll just go by there. Is what we're hearing from the president lining up with where the concerns of the majority of the American public seem to be?
Yeah, well, the president has lined up on all sides of this one, in fact. He has expressed concerns about, you know, the cure being worse than the disease. He's expressed those concerns almost immediately after announcing social distancing measures. And in the case last week, he announced that that there would be these new guidelines to guide governors in their plans to reopen, but that he was sort of turfing it over to the governors, giving the governors the responsibility. Of course, the Constitution also gives the governors the responsibility there. But as he did that, he said, you know, we want it to be slow. We want it to be responsible. And then within hours, he was tweeting, liberate Virginia, liberate Minnesota, liberate Michigan, targeting states with Democratic governors, of course, in some ways sort of contradicting his own recommendations shortly after making those recommendations. You know, it is a tough balance. The governors say that they're frustrated with having to have things be closed, but they also are putting health and safety first. And in some ways, as Amy was talking about this, it is a small part of the population that is doing these protests, but they're getting a lot of attention because it's something visual that's happening right now. And it's not unlike the Tea Party, the early days of the Tea Party movement, which ultimately did have a major influence on politics for a little while, though that certainly has faded at this point.
Well, it's sure to be a key campaign issue in the months ahead leading up to the November election. Another key issue was revealed to us in the form of new ads from both the Trump and Biden camps. This is going to be sort of a foreign policy test moving forward, how the U.S. handles its relationship with China. Take a quick listen to clips from both camps right now.
I believed in 1979, and I believe now, that a rising China is a positive development.
Deadly epidemic. But after 40 years, Joe Biden failed the test.
Trump praised the Chinese 15 times in January and February as the coronavirus spread across the world.
It's a tough situation. I think they're doing a very good job.
Amy and Tam, we just got a couple minutes left, but I want to make sure I get both of you on this. When you look at these dueling ads now, Amy, over to you first. What's your takeaway from this message?
Well, Trump is the one that really started this war of advertising on this issue of China. And, you know, there's nothing particularly new here. And an incumbent president trying to define his opponent as early as possible. In 2004, you'll remember the Swift boat ads. In 2012, you may remember the Obama attacks on Mitt Romney and Bain Capital. So this is all about sort of setting the stage right now, the incumbent president trying to put his opponent on his heels. Even an opponent as well known as Joe Biden is not as well defined as he will be come the fall. Biden pushing back, of course, with the worries of many Democrats ringing in his ears. Don't let yourself get swift voted.
Tam, is this the new line now? Is this the new question? Go ahead.
Well, yeah, what's notable about that Trump ad is that it's from a Trump super PAC. It is not from the Trump campaign itself. President Trump has had this sort of weird thing going on where sometimes he's very critical of China. Sometimes he's more critical of the WHO for not being critical enough of China. But then when reporters have asked him, well, what are you doing about China? He sort of backs off. President Trump has a very mixed record wanting to sort of promote the trade deal that he got with China. And in doing so, he has been reluctant to go too hard on China or on President Xi, and he's sort of vacillated back and forth, including a tweet at one point praising the transparency of President Xi in China.
It's an issue I'm sure we're going to be covering and sure to come up in both campaigns in the months ahead. Tamara Keith and Amy Walter, good to talk to you both.
Good to talk to you.
When you think of essential workers during this pandemic, typically first responders and hospital workers come to mind. But a key function of society is, of course, picking up our garbage to keep our communities clean. PBS station WTTW in Chicago is producing a firsthand series of conversations with individuals affected by the pandemic. Sanitation worker Sammy Datulo says that his job is as essential as ever.
Police officers can't stop doing what they're doing because of this virus. The fire department going to stop putting out a fire because they're worried about catching us? No, they're not going to do that. We can't stop doing what we're doing. We have to do our job. It's just like the first responders. You know, we serve, and now we're protecting because if we don't get their garbage, they got all this bacteria and, you know, and people can get affected by that. I take pride in my job. I love my job. I can't wait to get up in the morning to go to work. Because I love my job. And then what's great about, the best part about my job is the day goes by so fast. You know a certain place you need to be. Like say for 8 o'clock, well, if I'm at that place at 8 o'clock, I'm behind. It's a fun job, I mean, and I get paid for it. Now all of a sudden you got this virus, you gotta be careful. It's not like you just go out and you have no care in the world. You're just throwing garbage and now you gotta worry about what you touch. I am so vulnerable to it because you got water in the hopper, there's human feces in there sometimes, you know, diapers. Today, I got splashed in the face with water. I had to get my Clorox wipes and wipe my face. You get that splash in your face, you gotta make sure you got hand soap or hand sanitizer to wash your face because you get it in your mouth or your eyes or your ears, that's why you gotta keep washing your hands. When I'm working, now I'm not realizing, even though I got my gloves on, I'm touching stuff with garbage and I'm touching my steering wheel again. Well, I'm good. What happens if I take my gloves off? Touch the steering wheel. Oh, touch my face. Now I'm infected. You have to take extra precaution now because this is, you know, I can take this home to my family. I got a 4-year-old grandson that's there and I don't want to get him sick. I couldn't live with myself. My biggest fear is catching it. That's my biggest fear. Because I'm, you know, up in age, and I'm working on my retirement. I mean, could it affect me if I can't work again? You know, what happens if it affects my lungs or I can't breathe like I used to? Yeah, it's scary. Am I scared to go to work? Yes, I am. I'm not gonna lie. But if they don't have someone to take their garbage, what are they gonna do with it? They really rely on us. It's just do my job. I got to do it. It's something I have to do. There's something I have to do.
Sammy Datulo, we appreciate you and every single sanitation worker out there. Thank you. And that is a NewsHour for tonight. As you probably noticed, I am not in the studio tonight. I'm anchoring from home to help keep more of my colleagues safe. It's taken a lot of work by a lot of people behind the scenes to make this happen. I want to be sure to thank each and every one of them as we all continue to practice social distancing. I'm Judy Woodruff. Join us online and again here tomorrow evening. For all of us at the PBS NewsHour, thank you. Please stay safe yourself, and we'll see you soon.